Hello, welcome to About Regional. My name's Ian Campbell. I'm sitting here in wet boardies at Gorilla Bay, just south of Batemans Bay. It's about 29 degrees today, so I've been in the water for a dip just to cool down. It's a good place for snorkeling, I'm told, Gorilla Bay. Maybe next time. I've just had morning tea with Neville and Diane Baker at their place at Catalina. Neville is a cancer survivor, a breast cancer survivor. A fella with breast cancer, you ever struck this before? Neville's keen to share his story with men and the community to raise awareness.
I was at a breakfast meeting and I felt a burning in my right breast. Touched it and it felt like the nipple was about 3 centimetres long. So I thought something wasn't right there. Mm-hmm. So I went along to my GP and that's when he said it looks like it could be. So yeah, I had a lot of biopsies. And my Christmas present 2003 was to have it confirmed that I had breast cancer.
I'll bring you that conversation in a few weeks' time. Coming up in today's program, I'll introduce you to the accidental aid worker, Sue Liu. Also, the Australian National Busking Championships that have been based in Coomer for the last 5 years are about to go truly national. We'll chat to the founder of the Busking Championships, Alan Spencer, shortly. Those black cockatoos look like they're enjoying the Banksia cones in front of me. Indy Wood grew up in Tathra. He went to Bega High School and studied journalism at RMIT in Melbourne. His passion and his profession is radio. But his career had stalled until he answered an ad on the net earlier this year for a radio trainer based in Fiji. Since May this year, Indy's been working at Mix FM, Fiji's best mix, based in Latoka, just north of Nandi in sugarcane country. Indy is part of Australia's foreign aid effort to Fiji.
It's a part of a thing called Australian Volunteers for International Development, which is an Australian government initiative that gets its funding out of the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade. Australia sends volunteers into developing nations all over the world in huge amounts of different fields, IT stuff, education, science, you know, like all kinds of stuff. I had heard about the idea of doing this kind of stuff through a friend who at one stage went to Nairobi in Kenya to work in science. And so I kept an eye on the website, kind of going, you know, maybe one day something will come up in communications. Not thinking there'd ever be anything actually specifically in radio. But my little sister had been watching as well, and she sent me a text message at one point at the start of the year saying, I think your job just showed up. What? And I looked at it, and I just went, you know what? I can't not apply. I have to try. Yeah, I arrived in mid-May. So I'm essentially a volunteer. I am a volunteer. I'm paid an allowance out of the Australian government on a monthly basis, but I'm not paid by the organisation that I'm working for. Yep. And I'm not employed by the station. I'm here as a trainer to offer advice and kind of try and build some frameworks of, you know, better ways of broadcasting and better interview techniques, better presentation style, you know, research skills, trying to develop proper use of different software and prep practices and all that sort of stuff that you do when you're working in these kind of fields, making sure that you've researched and planned before you go on air and start saying anything too crazy. In my eyes, that's all advice to them, which they can take or leave. You know, they don't have any responsibility to do what I say. It's in their interest too. But so, you know, like I'm not too heavily invested in the whole operation. I'm here to help if they want it.
Can you see your influence starting to have an impact, improve things?
I think I'm actually really lucky when it comes to that stuff, being in the field that I'm in, because walking into the studio and saying things like, maybe try and stop the idea of saying welcome back every time we turn the mic on.
Yeah.
Radio practice.
I didn't go anywhere. Yeah.
Right? Yeah. But that kind of thing, they've taken it on board really quickly. Within a week, there was 3 or 4 bad habits that they had that were gone, you know? And so within 4 months, they're now scripting just about everything they say.
Yeah.
They're actually using the music software, the broadcast software, in the prep space to put their music playlists together before they walk into the studio, and not just knocking it together at the last minute before. You know, there's quite a lot of really simple changes that have taken place and are really noticeable, and we've had a lot of positive feedback on that.
Help us understand the value in this a bit more, Indy. Why is it that the Australian government invests taxpayer dollars in having you in Fiji performing this role in radio? I think many people sort of get the sense of, you know, Australian volunteers, Australian aid going in after a disaster, but many might be surprised to hear that our Foreign Affairs Department is investing in other countries through jobs like yours. Where's the benefit in your work, do you think, to Fiji, to the community you're working in?
The most obvious answer to that question straight away is, for anyone living in the region that you're in, one of the most powerful things that you and I have both been involved in is informing the public on things like bushfire. Yeah, being able to educate and inform your community in the case of natural disasters, you know, everyone's power goes out, everyone's hiding in bunkers and stuff in a cyclone situation, but they still have things like wind-up or solar radio.
Yeah.
And as long as even just one tower stays standing, that's how all the information is shared. So giving these guys the skills to be able to research and write clear-cut stuff that they read on air that actually informs the public on what to do, what not to do, where to go, where not to go, that really simple information, that's a huge benefit to people in any nation. Taking that more broadly, just in general, even when there's not a natural disaster, the power of radio to, in a conversation, to be able to share information and cause people to stop and think. Like, you know, that's, it might not be an obvious thing to people straight away, but it's a really important thing as far as development of a society.
Hear, hear, buy that man a beer. Good on you, Indy. What about yourself and adjusting to the Fijian way of life? Fiji time, as many people will know it. How have you settled into the community?
It's been an interesting experience. I walked into Fiji and there's modern cars, there's, you know, basically all the same food, there's, you know, it's a fairly modern society in most ways, and I kind of went, culture shock? Yeah, nah.
Yeah.
Like, really? You know? And I'm working in a radio station, they're playing all the same kind of music that they play on most of the commercial stations around Australia.
Familiar turf, yeah.
This is the same stuff. This is just what I've been used to. It's okay. But then that thing of the island time and things happening at a slow pace started to get frustrating. But then also just there's such a civilized, polite society that the idea of questioning the boss was totally inappropriate to most of the staff, but then also doing an interview with someone who's considered an expert in their field, and then me saying, hang on, what did you mean by that? Push him. Fuck him. Ask the fucking question. Okay? And then looking at him like, but how do I ever do that? Or you know, the just even in the presentation style, the approach they take on air, they add all these extra, what they see as polite words, like this song goes out to this person, and not forgetting this person. And when I say to them, take out the word not forgetting, because it's not needed, they go, but doesn't that sound abrupt? And they think they're being really rude.
What have you noticed in yourself as you adjust to Fiji time, to the Fiji way of doing things?
I mean, you know, there's a whole other element to this for me, though, Ian, in that I arrived here having not actually spent any full-time work in a radio studio for nearly 7 years, trying my damnedest to find a place for myself in that industry and battling against, you know, the scarcity of jobs and the competition and how popular this industry seems to have become in my, you know, in my lifetime. So I guess I walked into this job wondering whether I actually was up to it and whether I would actually know what I was doing in the industry. And I feel somewhat, at least somewhat, reassured that, you know, I've made some change and that I actually do know how to be a journalist and do know how to, you know, do a radio show. And yeah.
Perhaps one of the failings of aid work, overseas volunteer work in the past is that the outside culture has been imposed on the culture of the country that the volunteer is going to. Is that something that you're aware of?
I've noticed a few things that I've found quite interesting. One of them was that a handful of people have been looking to me to help the people in this station and the people in this community with things like correct pronunciation of words,
yep,
or the correct use of certain words. And I have tried to do bits of that, but at the same time I have this thing going on in my head of like, no, you know, like, you guys have a cultural standard,
yeah,
that says that this is how you do things, and by me correcting you all the time, I'm, you know, maybe for a start, maybe I'm making you feel stupid by doing that, but also I'm westernising your approach to everything. Fiji has a very clearly developed culture of that was built around oral history, so and a language that's built on what is it, like phonetics, I guess, like each individual letter in the Fijian language has its own specific sound. You'll never find the letter A pronounced in two or three different ways the way that we do in English. So when they see David Bowie's name, for example, the default to David Bowie, because that's how you would pronounce that particular word,
yeah,
in using that combination of letters in the Fijian language.
Yeah.
There's no question. And so when I get the owner of this station, who happens to be an Australian who's been here since 1971,
yeah,
coming to me and saying, they need to work on the pronunciation, they keep calling him David Bowie. And I'm like, well, yeah, okay, I agree, but that's not how his name is pronounced. But do we want to see over the next two or three generations that suddenly that word,
yeah,
suddenly that culture changes?
In Fiji, that's how you say it. Yeah. And what's wrong with that? Yeah.
Their language is incredible. I'm picking up bits and pieces of it, but, like, you know, there's like I said, each letter, each individual letter has a specific sound, and that's it.
What have you learned about Australia in terms of Australia working? You've learned anything about your motherland from abroad?
I don't know that we've got it any better, really. I don't know that we do any better as a country as far as how much work we get done. These guys, things are slow. It can take a matter of days, weeks or months for a request for one thing to happen. But in the process of waiting, it's very civilised and polite and professional, and there's no anxiety around things. Things get done, it's okay, you're all good,
yep,
you know? And there's cultural significance to certain ways that things get done. And, you know, like, the amount of effort that's put in here to showing that you have manners and, you know, that you acknowledge the people around you and respect your elders and, you know, it's that's everything,
yeah,
in society.
Indy Wood speaking to us from Lotoka, Fiji, which sits near Nandi, right in the heart of Fiji's sugarcane country. This is About Regional, a program that looks to showcase the people, issues and colour of southeast New South Wales. Thanks for tuning in. And staying with that idea of foreign aid, let me introduce you to Sue Liu. Sue is a self-confessed travel junkie, although as she gets older, she's starting to slow down a bit. In 2004, she'd just returned home from Sri Lanka when the Boxing Day tsunami struck. Her first thought was for the people she'd left behind just a matter of weeks before. Like many people, she wanted to help. But so much so, Sue now calls herself the accidental aid worker. She's written a book about this journey. The book funds her ongoing charity work. She's just finished a book tour of South Coast libraries, stopping in at Nowra, Ulladulla, Batemans Bay, Naruma, Maruya, Tura and Bermagui. A big part of Sue's story is Bruno, a Sri Lankan travel guide.
In fact, the first thing that I did once I learnt of the news that the tsunami had hit the Sri Lankan coastline is I called his mobile, just to make sure that he was safe, of course. But communications were down in the country, so it took a few days for him to get back to us. But he eventually we got in touch via email, and he was saying that he was actually safe and not part of that disaster.
And then you turned to your friends here at home around Sydney, your friends and connections in Australia, and you received an overwhelming response.
That's right, because you know, like many people after that event, in the initial stages I gave money to the Red Cross. I donated more money than I'd ever donated because of the enormity of the situation. But after that, I was still left with the feeling of wanting to do more, to participate. It seems that when I eventually did contact people around me to say I was wanting to do something physical for Sri Lanka, like collecting goods, I just seemed to that seemed to resonate with a lot of people, and in a short period of time, 2.5 weeks, I ended up collecting about $18,000 worth of goods.
What sort of stuff?
Well, initially the request was for physical things like roll mats and tents and camping gear, and because I'd just come back from my world travels and, you know, had no intention of ever pitching a tent ever again, I thought, I've got all that in my garage and I'm never going to use it again. So I figured, well, that's the start of a collection. And I thought, look, if I get half a dozen tents and a half a dozen sleeping bags, we'll be right. But I ended up having to actually coach people through the whole process, because I actually say in my emails out to them, imagine that you've lost everything and you live in a tropical country. What are the basic things that you would need? It'd be soap, it'd be shampoo. A lot of the ladies have long hair, so, you know, hair bands and things like that.
You took on a great sense of ownership and responsibility on the back of that overwhelming response from your network. That prompted you to, I guess, see this through to the end, and Bruno helped you with that too.
Yes, well, look, my original intention was to just collect the goods, make sure I can get them over there, and then he could just catch it on the other side. And if you know anything, if you look at a map of Sri Lanka, Colombo is on the western side, and the town that these goods were designated for was Trincomalee, which is on the northeastern side, and it's about a six-hour drive by road in a straight line. So my intention was, look, get it on sea, get it over there, and then he can just pick it up with a truck and then get it up there and it'll be distributed. But it got to the point where I was doing the math, and because I'd asked people when they bought me things, how much did you spend, or if you're donating goods, just give me an idea of, you know, its approximate value.
Yep.
And when I added that all up, it came to $18,000 worth, and I thought, you know, that's too much to ask for someone who really doesn't have probably the skills to take on board. So it was my responsibility to see it through.
And Bruno put you in touch with someone on the ground there that really helped that effort.
That's right. So initially when I was going on that "I'm just going to hand it over to you" idea, I said to him, I need to know that there's somebody responsible on the other side, like a community leader, who can actually take receipt of these goods and then get them efficiently out to the refugees in the refugee camps. Because I had these visions and I was seeing these images on the news of people sort of, you know, clambering over the back of trucks and grabbing things. And I certainly didn't want the things that I had so carefully collected and packed to be just squandered and not managed. So he ended up basically, and he actually didn't know this person either. He didn't even know his name, I believe. But he said, look, there's a priest, I hear there's a priest, and he's actually a headmaster, and he has access to a school. So, and his name was Father Javanadas, and he was the principal and a priest in the town of Trincomalee.
This experience changed your life. You describe yourself as the accidental aid worker. This experience really informed the years that have followed.
Yes, it has. I think when you're involved in that kind of work, and people who are involved in community development work and helping people, you do get enormous satisfaction out of helping people. I think it can be a little addictive. But I also think it can be a salve for your own personal issues, and I'm not alone in admitting that. Mm-hmm. In fact, I think as people get through their lives and they're constantly giving, I think they come to a realisation at some stage that it's a salve for something else. But, yes, in my time, when I tally it up, I've been doing voluntary community and aid and fundraising work for 12 years and more and counting.
You welcome and accept contributions to your work now, but you also encourage people to do what you've done in a way, to go out and do their own work.
To some degree, I think it's not for everyone. I mean, I'm a marketing consultant and, you know, have the skills. And I think what I was trying to do at the beginning was use my skills and my powers for good. So in organising and communicating about collecting goods and, you know, logistics on sea, that's kind of the thing that I do in my work day anyway. Of course, you know, the type of giving and contribution that you make has to be appropriate to what your passions are.
Yep.
And what you can afford to give. If you are involved in something and passionate about something, say, for instance, it could be a health issue like breast cancer, it could be a sporting club, it could be a music group, it could be a literacy program, is to really search out others in your area that share the same passion. And also, if it does exist, some kind of formalised structure that you can, or organisation that you can actually join in with, because it's about building that community.
Mm-hmm. You make a great point, and it's a particularly relevant point for this region, which is really known for its volunteering. But you make the great point that you need to look after yourself. You need to earn a living, because if you can't earn a living, you can't do the voluntary work
that you do. And I think I'm turning it on its head a bit. I mean, I've been doing it for a long time, and at times I've had to let it go, and at times I've had to... I've been doing more than two or three or four different types of fundraising or awareness raising. I think it goes beyond just asking people to give money. In some circumstances, that money is the best option, but I think if there are other options for getting people involved and engaged, that you should try to do those things. You can't endlessly give, and you can't... you can endlessly give if you want to, but like the comment that you made before is you do have to look after yourself at some stage, because if you aren't in a situation to give, you're just depleting your own well. So I encourage people to just make sure that they're in a good position before they actually help others. It's the same principle as, you know, when you're on an aircraft and you put your oxygen mask on first. I'm a believer of that.
Sue Lu speaking to us during her South Coast book tour. Sue's book is called Accidental Aid Worker. Good one for Christmas, good one for some summer reading. It's available through Sue's website, accidentalaidworker.com.au. Hello, this is Ian Campbell sitting in wet board shorts at Gorilla Bay for About Regional. Just a gentle swell rolling into Gorilla Bay today. There's a decent swell next door at Mackenzie's Beach. There was about a dozen surfers out in the water enjoying those waves. More sedate here at Gorilla Bay. People in the water snorkeling. Lovers, young and old, walking along the beach, picking up pebbles as they go. Thanks for tuning in. Thanks for your interest in the program. Shortly, we'll hear from Alan Spencer, the founder of the Australian National Busking Championships at Cooma. Next year, the championships will become a truly national competition. After 5 years in Cooma, the championships will drop in on regional towns and cities up and down the East Coast. Alan will tell us more shortly. Some music from this year's competition first, though. This is Matt Brooker, who took out the Open Champion category at the Busking Championships this year, a tune called Ocean City Sounds. Some great playing there from Matt Brooker. You can see why he did well at the 2016 Australian National Busking Championships. That track is called Ocean City Sounds. Comes from a CD that's just been launched called Busk, featuring some of the stars of the festival over the last 5 years. People like Guy Lilliman, Mike Martin and the String Family. Busk is available from the Cooma School of Music. Alan Spencer is the principal of the Cooma School of Music and the founder of the Australian National Busking Championships. For the last 5 years, the championships have taken over Cooma on the first weekend in November. And while talent from across the nation has been drawn to the streets of Cooma to compete, that claim of being a national championship didn't carry the weight that the name implies. But that changes next year. With the backing of Rotary clubs along the East Coast, the Busking Championships will cover three states and at least six regional centres.
Yeah, we've got some wonderful stories, really. There's Guy Lilliman, who's a Canberra-based musician, and he won the title Open Champion back in 2013 and 2014, two in a row. And on the strength of 2013, he was picked up by an agent and he had a tour of South Africa along with his partner, right. Amelia Gibson. And I think they did four or five big festivals over there, as well as a lot of gigs in Pretoria and major cities. Had a very successful tour. And just recently, he's just come back from a 10-week tour of Afghanistan, entertaining Australian troops and NATO troops there. So that was an amazing experience for him. And so, yeah, he's really becoming, well-known now. So that's fantastic.
Did you see the potential in this festival for that sort of stuff to happen?
I did. Look, because I've been in the music industry now for over 40 years, I've got a lot of friends who are musicians, and it's always been, I suppose, a bit of a crusade of mine to try and promote talent, through concerts and various competitions I've run over the years. And I just saw this as a natural fit for me to be promoting these up-and-coming musicians, really. Yeah.
What about locally, for local musicians and businesses? What impact has the championship had on them?
Well, I've been talking to some of the businesses after this event, and a lot of them are saying it's their best trading day of the year. So they're very, very happy. And I think that the proof of the pudding is that every year that all our wonderful local businesses put up their hand to sponsor the event, and now it's over $10,000 in cash, so that's really putting their money where their mouth is, really. So
this is really taking busking to a whole new level. This is more than throwing a busker a few coins in their case, isn't it?
It is. And we're always exploring new ways of promoting the better busker. This year we've brought out a CD called Busk, and it features 14 of the best quality busking over the 5 years, and we so we hope that'll be another vehicle to promote buskers as a sort of a sample of the talent that's out there.
Is busking a legitimate art on its own?
Yep.
Do people choose to busk rather than play at a club on a stage or in a stadium somewhere like that? People choose to busk?
Yeah, they do choose to busk. And I think there's, some people, it's a necessity, to pay the rent, mm-hmm. basically. For other people, it's a career. There's one chap here on Saturday, who Michael Jones, who is Michael, the Australia's Living Poet, he calls himself. He's got this gigantic couch. Anyway, he goes around to all the festivals, and he tells me he's been doing this for 10 years mm-hmm. now. So there are buskers that are doing it as their career. It's not an easy career, mm-hmm. but they really enjoy the freedom of being able to be their own boss and to play their music. So good luck to them.
It must feel good as the fellow that got this off the ground to see this success unfolding.
Yeah, well, it is. And I'm not sort of skiting, but I think that the proof is, that what's actually happening. And And yeah, it does actually. Don't do this; I'll start tearing up because it is very gratifying. And all these musicians are terrific people in themselves, and it's just great to be able to help them along a little bit.
Yeah. Alan, you touched on it earlier, and I'm keen to know more now. The plans for the Australian National Busking Championships, the festival is starting to go beyond Cooma.
A couple of years ago, We got involved with the Cooma Rotary Club because I was doing the festival basically with just a few friends, and it was just getting a bit too hard for us to manage ourselves. And Rotary came on board, and since then they've been fantastic help with all the volunteers they provide, plus the public liability that covers the event. But then again, you see, Rotary clubs are all around Australia, and when the word got out that Cooma Rotary was doing it, a lot of other Rotary clubs started getting interested, the first one being Stanthorpe in Queensland. And so at the end of February of this year, we actually did a Australian National Busking Championship regional final up in Stanthorpe, and it was a fantastic success, and they're keen to do it again. And then, of course, the penny dropped, and now we've got Ballarat in Victoria, Wangaratta in Victoria, Noosa Heads, another Queensland operation, and Naruma down the coast is very interested in becoming involved. And hot off the press, your first one to know. I just got a phone call from Berry Rotary, in the Shell Haven. They're extremely interested in it, so we're setting up a meeting with them. So we could have like five or six towns next year.
So legitimately, it is now the Australian National Busking Championship.
Totally. Yeah, we're in three states.
What will Cooma's role be in that? You described those different places as hosting regional finals. What role will Cooma play?
So I think that at the moment, Cooma is the grand final, I suppose, the national final. It will morph into, a 2-day event. Mm-hmm. My leanings are, I'd have to talk with Rotary about this, but my leanings would be to have it like the first Saturday of November, so it still coincides with Snowy Ride, would be Cooma's regional final, if you like. And then the Sunday, the following day, we could have our grand national final, and which would involve all those other towns.
Alan Spencer there, the founder of the Australian National Busking Championships. From its home base in Cooma, next year the championships will cover three states and at least six regional centres. Busk, the CD that marks the success of the championships over the last 5 years, is out now and available from the Cooma School of Music. Our time together at Gorilla Bay is coming to an end. The black cockatoos are starting to move on as well. Feels like there's a southerly change on the way to stop the day getting any hotter. It's currently sitting at about 29 degrees. Thanks for your interest. Thanks for your time. Your feedback and story ideas are always welcome. And I'm always happy to talk sponsorship opportunities as well. You'll find all my contact details at the About Regional website. We can also connect via Facebook, Twitter and LinkedIn. While you're exploring the About Regional website, take a look at Kate Burke's latest article. Kate is a well-known singer-songwriter. She performs regularly at music festivals across Australia with her mate Ruth Hazelton. You might have heard of the recent cuts at ABC Radio National. Many of the music programs that have been part of the RN stable for many, many years have been cut. They won't be part of the program schedule next year. Kate has written of the impact this will have on regionally based artists. It's an article that's generating a lot of comment. Take a look, leave your own thoughts at the About Regional website. My name's Ian Campbell. Thanks for tuning in. Look after yourself. We'll chat again in a couple of weeks' time.